The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Huge place. I didn't bring music to the ballroom here, so I thought I was expected to bring some. Right, exactly. Anyway, let me, like you in 1968, this is still a very young revolution, essentially to give you background. On January 1st, 1959, a multi-class, and I emphasize multi-class, democratic revolution came to power in Cuba, and within less than 2 years, it was clear that that revolution was going into, for short, I would call the Soviet model, model on the social economic system existing in the USSR. But even though it was and continues to be in the more democratic, for many years it had a great deal of popular support. It built extensive and generous social welfare state type of structure. There was, particularly with the departure of tens of thousands of upper and middle class people, the, at least in those terms, and also population growth, which was quite significant, there was a great deal of social mobility. And of course, the opposition to US imperialism that also contributed to the development of popular support. So the question is, how did this still young revolution that is on January 1st, 1968, was the ninth anniversary of the Cuban Revolution, so it was still quite young. How did it react to the dramatic events that took place in 1968? And the reaction was rather different than that the Western left expressed. If I were to summarize how the Western left, broadly speaking, reacted, it was very much in favor of the revolution that was going on, the rebellion revolution that was going on in Vietnam against US imperialism, as well as, for large parts of the left, also supporting the democratic movements in Eastern Europe, whether in Czechoslovakia or also Poland and Yugoslavia, where student movements, quite significant student movements, had grown up in 1968. In Poland in March, Yugoslavia in June. And then, of course, needless to say, that left supported the incredible events of Paris in May in 68. That's how the international left reacted. The reaction of the Cuban government, because the media was completely and totally, to this day, the mainstream media, the official media, all the mass media was controlled by the government and continues to be controlled by the government, was very strongly in support of the Vietnamese revolution, but as it turned out, hostile to the insurgents and the liberalization that was going on in Czechoslovakia, and didn't say a word about Poland and Yugoslavia. And in terms of, so anything that had to do with the Eastern Bloc, either opposed or kept silent about, but more telling, and this is something that I was able to find in my recent research, which I looked at all the Grama is the official Communist Party daily in Cuba. I looked up every single newspaper from January 1st, 68 to December 31st of that year. And when it came to the events in Paris, as well as the suppression of the student movement in Mexico, the Cuban government abstained from making any judgments. That is essentially reported it in quote-unquote objective language. So-and-so said this and so-and-so said that. De Gaulle said this, the student said that, without really, like news report, you know, giving quote-unquote an objective view without in any way commenting about what they felt about what was going on. And certainly nothing similar to how they approached the events in Vietnam, which was clearly not just objective reporting, but also very strong partisan support for what was going on there. At the same time, and this is much less known, domestically, this I'm talking about how the Cuban government reacted to foreign events that year, but domestically it was a very important year for Cuba. A lot of important changes took place domestically in Cuba, that particularly the nationalization of the tiniest, and by tiniest I mean literally hauling the world bodegas, all of that was nationalized in 1968 in Cuba, and the development of new forms of repression. So what I want to do in the time I have today is to present, first of all, the foreign policy part, relation how the Cuban government reacted to what was going on abroad, and also talk about the domestic events that few people are familiar with, but Cubans who grew up during that time are extremely familiar with. So first let me start by talking about foreign policy before talking about the domestic policy. And essentially what I would contend is that there was a two-sided foreign policy in Cuba. On one hand, big support for the guerrilla movement that was taking place in several Latin American countries, including Venezuela, for example. Not only support, but many times organized by the Cuban government itself. And but also always with the foreign policy interest of the Cuban state always in the back of that support. In other words, the Cuban government refrained from supporting any guerrilla movements in Mexico, which there were such movements in Mexico in the 1970s, because Mexico was the only country in the Western Hemisphere which refused to break up diplomatic relations with Cuba. Even though, very hypocritically, the same Mexican government was photographing every person going to Cuba from Mexico City and passing on that information to the CIA. So the Mexican government itself was playing both sides against the middle. But nonetheless, they would not support any movement of protest. And when Tlatelolco happened in October, which is a big massacre of students, the Cuban government also played this quote-unquote objective of just reporting what the press and the official sources in particular were saying, underestimating, of course, the vastness of that repression, which was hundreds of people that were killed. That was very much played down by the Cuban press. Nonetheless, even though the state interests of Cuba were always prominent in support of the guerrilla movement, nonetheless, it is true that it gave a great deal of support for and often organized that movement, and it intervened also in the internal politics of guerrilla movements and supporting some and opposing others according to their line and how close they were politically to the Cuban government. But it's certainly true that they did support the guerrilla movements that were organized in a very similar way to the Cuban government, as if from the top down. That was one of the characteristics of the guerrilla movement. But again, they would never support a guerrilla movement against a government that was friendly or becoming friendly with the Cuban government. And of course, there is also the case of Spain, where the issue of guerrillas was not present, but after a very rough start, at least in 1960, there was a lot of friction between the Cuban and Franco's government, the dictator in Spain. Very soon afterwards, they came to an agreement, and the issue of Spain, that before the revolution had been a burning issue for the Cuban left, be it communist or non-communist left. You know, I grew up, you know, with Spain being the center of, if you will, of my political education in Cuba, because that was the burning issue for in Cuba, particularly when there were large numbers of Spanish immigrants who came to Cuba in the early part of the 20th century. So they quickly reached an agreement with Franco to continue diplomatic and economic relations, and the Cuban press after that did not say a critical word about Spain. Not one critical word about Spain. Now, notwithstanding far more qualified policy than sometimes the pro-Castro left conveys in the United States, the fact is that even that policy, which is more qualified, came into conflict with the Soviet Union. That is, after all, the Soviet Union had reached an agreement with the United States to respect each other's sphere of influence. That's why when there was a revolution in Hungary, it was a great deal of rhetoric in the U.S. government of sympathy for the Hungarian Revolution, but they would not, of course, move a finger to give any support to it. Why? Because Hungary was part of their backyard. Similarly, Latin America was and is considered the backyard of the United States, the sphere of influence of the United States. So the Soviet Union was very, very unhappy with the fact that the Cuban government was violating that understanding by supporting guerrillas in the Western Hemisphere, Latin America. And a great deal of friction developed between the Soviet Union and the Cuban government, which led in the year 67 to the cutting down on the oil deliveries of the Soviet Union to Cuba, and the Cuba in turn denouncing the Venezuelan and Colombian Communist parties and the Soviet Union for supporting them because they were not really revolutionary. So there was a great deal of friction. And the year 68 is also important because that is the year that when Castro decided to support the invasion of Czechoslovakia by the Soviet Union, that was the turning point. The turning point for the end of the friction between the Soviet Union and the Cuban government. That is, up to that point, Cuba's support for guerrilla warfare was really pissing off the Soviet Union. And tremendous pressure, tremendous friction. I'm talking about fairly public too, by the way. And in August of 68, Castro uses the issue of the invasion of Czechoslovakia to make a turn in its relation with the Soviet Union and try to reach an understanding with the Soviet Union. And that was what his support for the invasion of Czechoslovakia signified, which surprised the hell out of the Cuban people, because between July and August 68 is when the invasion happened, the Cuban press had been reporting both the communist parties in the Europe that were supporting the Czechoslovakian reform as well as those that were opposing without taking sides. But when the actual invasion came, Fidel Castro decided to throw in his lot with the Soviet Union and support it. And after that began a process of rapprochement with the Soviet Union that ended up in what essentially was a honeymoon period with the Soviet Union that lasted from 68 to wait until Gorbachev, until the mid-80s, and with Gorbachev, tensions again began to develop 1985, 1986. But from 68 to 85, you have a fairly harmonious, there were some tactical differences. For example, as part of the Cuban government playing down its intervention to support the Latin American guerrillas, not to offend the Soviet Union. They didn't completely eliminate the support, but they played it down as a way to avoid frictions with the Soviet Union. At the same time, they began to make, for example, all sorts of things that the Cuban government did to make up with the Soviet Union, including joining the economic union that the Soviet Union had developed, Comecon, that had developed with the Eastern European countries, of which Cuba became a member. That is, Cuba was the only non-European member of that economic alliance. So, at the same time, with the Cuban government playing down its support for guerrillas in Latin America, they began to increase its involvement in Africa. Why? because in Africa there was a strategic agreement between the Soviet Union and Cuba. Africa was not part of the sphere of influence of the Cuban government. So the greater involvement, because there had been some involvement in Africa, particularly in the Maghreb, that is in Algeria and so on, where the Cuban government supported Benbella, but nothing that came about in the 70s. With a massive intervention on one hand in Angola and South Africa, which was progressive, if you want to use that term, but quite reactionary, in my view, with its intervention in the Horn of Africa, that is Ethiopia and Eritrea. So there was, but in both cases, strategically, that intervention in Africa was in agreement with the Soviet Union, even though there were certain tactical differences about which particular groups to support at various times and so on. But strategically, now Cuba was in, the Cuban government was engaging in a policy in Africa that was in agreement, in broad agreement with that of the Soviet Union, which was not, had not been the case for the policy in Latin America. So this is, and I'm making, I'm trying to synthesize as much as I can because it's all the things I want to talk about here, but this is 68, again, it's critical in the change of great friction with the Soviet Union because of the support for the guerrilla warfare to accommodation with the Soviet Union. August 68, it's a turning point. It's a pivot in the in Cuban foreign policy. So this is happening in the foreign front. At the same time, there were policies at home that are to this day in the minds of Cubans who lived through that period. And one of them was in 1960, that is shortly after the Victory of the Revolution, middle-sized and big business were nationalized in Cuba, both foreign and domestic. But small businesses, family business, were left untouched. In March of 68, the government announces the nationalization of every single business. I'm talking here about hamburger stands or the puestos de fritas, as we used to call them in Cuba at that time. Every puesto de frita in Havana, which was like literally little stands in the corners, every puesto de frita, every bodega, everything was nationalized. And because some of these units were so tiny, half of them were closed. No, a third of them were closed shortly after because it was, it made no sense for the state to be running them. By the way, half of the nationalized units in that year had no employees. These were really mom and pop type of stores. 50% of them had no employees at all, and the rest probably had one or two employees. Very tiny, very small business. And now why, and the total was, by the way, 55,636 small business were nationalized within like a period. The nationalization was announced on March 13th, 1968, and with 15 days later, they announced that they had nationalized 55,000, over 55,000 businesses. Now why would they want to do something like that? One thing is that the Cuban government, which had a high degree of support and legitimacy at this time because of the reasons I mentioned earlier, wanted to achieve as complete and total control of the labor force as possible for a variety of reasons. For one thing, this, as small as this business were, they were actually competing with the Cuban state in obtaining agricultural goods. That is, they were willing to pay small farmers more for their products than the state was willing to pay. So right off the bat, they eliminated the competition by just simply either nationalizing or closing them down. That, of course, only worsened the situation of distribution in Cuba. So that was one reason to do it. But more broadly speaking, I think it was, a lot of people, including myself, think that it was a response to the government, to the economic crisis that was going in Cuba. It was a desperate measure. A desperate measure that reached the degree that in 1971, they actually approved a law, the enforcement of which has never been clear as to which, to what extent was actually enforced, establishing compulsory labor in Cuba. That is, this was a law that was approved in March of 1971. How much was it enforced? I haven't been able to find anybody who could tell me that. So it was a situation of desperate economic crisis that I would contend that was primarily based on domestic factors, qualitatively worsened by the blockade. That is, I think, contrary to what parts of the anti-imperialist left, or so-called anti-imperialist left claims in this country, the principal reason was domestic, not the blockade. To be sure, the criminal blockade that the U.S. had established in 1960 certainly made the situation much more difficult and made it qualitatively worse. But the fact is that it was an economic system that was chaotic. Totally top-down administration. Tremendously chaotic inefficiency and inefficient. Machinery would be imported from the Eastern Bloc and just sit unused and rusting, especially with the climate of humidity, high humidity that exists in Cuba. So there was a tremendous economic waste, some of the aid, or a lot of the aid, that the Eastern European countries, and of course, not only imports from the Eastern European bloc, but also from all the other capitalist countries that did not join in the blockade. The fact of the matter is that the United States was the only major capitalist country that engaged in the blockade of Cuba. I mean, it was serious, to be sure. But one of the reasons that the Cuban government was very reluctant to support openly the main events in France in 68 was, number one, that de Gaulle, Charles de Gaulle, refused to toe the American line on the blockade, and number two, he had just signed a trade pact with Cuba earlier that year. So there were material factors that created a very chaotic situation in Cuba. It was a very much a from-the-top economic system with no transparency at all, poor information, a worker apathy that was based on neither material, that is, you work better, we pay you better, nor political incentives. What I call a political incentive is workers' control, trade union independence. The trade unions became total tools of the state. There was certainly nothing even remotely resembling workers' control. So there were neither political incentives nor material incentives for workers to produce. So worker apathy was very, very, very major factor in Cuba. And on top of that was the arbitrariness of Fidel Castro's micromanagement of the economy. That is, Fidel thought of himself as an expert on everything under the sun, from military strategies and tactics to cattle science. And there was the infamous, this is one of many examples of disastrous micromanagement by Fidel Castro, was the infamous F1 hybrid cows. That is, he decided to develop this hybrid cows in Cuba that supposedly would be produce a lot more milk and meat and so on. And he actually hires two British experts that he hired, he chose them, and they came to Cuba and said, no, I don't think that's a good idea. So he said, fuck you, and send them back to Britain. You see, he was going to get his way, even though his own expert that he hired advised against it. So again, there was a system that was chaotic, bureaucratic, from the top down, made qualitatively worse by the blockade that was going on in Cuba. Now, one of the aspects of this nationalization of tiny small businesses in Cuba is a very important one, which will lead me to talk about the third and final point, which is the issue of new forms of repression in Cuba. And one of the aspects of this nationalization was that the government closed all bars in Cuba, both private and state. So it wasn't just against privately owned bars. Also, they closed down every state-owned bar as well. Now, was it like the Women's Temperance Union used to be ran here in Evanston, Illinois, and here? No, it had nothing to do with alcohol. This is what's interesting. It was not an issue about alcohol. It was an issue that the bars created a social atmosphere that ran contrary to the militaristic, ascetic politics that the government wanted to establish. It was the sociability of the bars that they were objecting to, not the alcohol that they were objecting to. You know, with the kind of climate that in Cuba and all the many other reasons, until relatively recently, now alcohol, ever since the economic hardship of the fall of the Soviet Union, then alcohol began to become a problem in Cuba. But there was no history until then, before or after the revolution, that alcoholism was a serious issue. Of course, there were people who were drunk, but it wasn't like in Russia or Scandinavia or countries like that, which have had a very heavy. That wasn't the case, or for that matter, in the Caribbean. You know, it's not part of the. There are other problems to worry about, not alcoholism. But alcoholism wasn't the reason here. And that is connected to what I'm going to talk about, new forms of repression, because what happens is that the old bars, state or privately, were closed because the government wanted to create this quote-unquote new man, capital N, that based on a very ascetic militaristic model, a model, by the way, that Che Guevara was all for. I may mention that parenthetically. It is true that the government closed down the UMAP camps. These were camps in 1965 that were created to develop forced labor for gay people, for Jehovah Witnesses, for African-Cuban followers of ACUAL, which was a secret society, not political, but a secret society, like a secret fraternity. All of this, these people like this were sent to the UMAPs. UMAPs were closed in 1968, but because they found out that it wasn't giving them any new labor that was worth mentioning, and it didn't work. But what accompanied this kind of closure of bars was the beginnings of an effort to crack down on dissidents on the left. And one of the examples of this was the infamous Escalante case. Aníbal Escalante was a leader of the old Cuban Communist Party that was pro-Moscow. And this is the second time he was being put on trial. The first time he was put on trial because he, you know, these people were pretty awful themselves. I'm not making a case for them. He was trying to capture, he was the leading member of the old Cuban Communist Party, pro-Moscow Cuban Communist Party, that were trying to capture the state apparatus and put their people everywhere. So Fidel Castro said, the only boss here is me, not you. And he got rid of him and he went to prison. This time was rather different. This time was a real issue of political differences. And Escalante implicitly challenging the monolithism of the one-party state. That's not ideological. He was all for it, provided that he wasn't the loser. But what happened is that he developed a very small group of all members of the Cuban Communist Party that began to meet with each other and with East European diplomats to focus on the screw-ups of the Cuban economy. And by the way, they turned out to be right on some of these things. For example, one of the things that they were critical, and they were absolutely correct, is this absolutely insane campaign in 1970, which started really in the summer of 68, to have a 10 million ton sugar crop in Cuba, which meant a disruption of the whole economy. Because transport was all screwed up. It was, you know, trying to do that, you know, really screwed up the rest of the economy, and it was an incredible failure. And they predicted it in 1968. But the fact is that the whole nature of the trial, and interestingly enough, Raúl Castro, who of the two Castro brothers was the one who had closer ties to the old Cuban communists, because he had been a member of the communist youth. He was put in charge of charging Escalante, which he did with great gusto, because whatever nostalgia he had for the Soviet Union, he cared a lot more for develop a monolithic Cuban state. That's what he cared most about. And so he was in prison once again. And not only in 68 was Escalante in prison with another 15 or 20 others, but also this was the year, which turned out to be very consequential, where the Padilla case began later that year in 68. So it's all of this in 68. And Heberto Padilla was a product of the revolution. He had been a journalist, and he wrote, but somebody with tendencies to deviate.
Thank you.
With tendencies to deviate from the official line, and he published this book of poems called Fuera de Juego, Out of the Game. And the Artists Union had made a mistake of appointing a jury for that prize that turned out to give it to Padilla. And all shit broke out once the government found out he had been given that prize. UNIAC is the Cuban Writers and Artists Union, had to pull back and criticize that prize. They already had given it to him, but said we made a mistake. And the Cuban government went all out to denounce Heberto Padilla. So much so that when in 69 Heberto Padilla began to give talks in Cuba and try to write a new book, you know, they decided that this was too much. And in 1971, and this was an international scandal, Heberto Padilla made a classic Stalinist confession. One of those confessions, he said, I have seen, I've been unfair to the Cuban Revolution and to the Castro leadership, etc., etc., etc. Well, that confession in 1971, which started the process of 68 with the publication of Fuera de Juego, created an incredible international scandal, which had impacts everywhere. I remember people in the American Communist Party being critical of People's World, which was the Communist Party newspaper in the West Coast, very much followers of Dorothy Healy. They were writing articles criticizing the Cuban government about it. And of course, there was a petition signed by incredibly prominent intellectual, Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, Julio Cortázar, and other major figures in Latin America, denouncing the Cuban government with that. So there is then the inability to express solidarity, number one, with many of the movements that, like the May movement, or to denounce the what happened at Tlatelolco. Number two, this nationalization of small business that worsened the situation of distribution in Cuba. And number three, a new forms of repression. The last example I want to give of that new forms of repression is that in January, okay, in 1968, I mean, everything happened in 68. In January 68, a huge Congress of intellectuals is called in Cuba. And Ralph Millivan was there, Hobsbawm was there, big figures of the time show up in Cuba, and it appears that the Congress was functioning very openly. People were presenting motions and this and the other. Well, there was a problem though. Certainly the foreign intellectuals who were there didn't know that a group of black Cuban intellectuals had intended to present a motion criticizing the government for being insufficiently involved in fighting racism in Cuba. Because what happened in Cuba, there was the abolition of segregation in 1962, and the black people certainly benefited from that, as they also benefited from the class legislation that blacks benefited from, because they were among the poorest people in Cuba. So no question that blacks had benefited from the revolution. But when it came to running the show, the phenomenon of affirmative action was unknown in Cuba, was in fact disregarded in Cuba, and has only been occasionally implemented in specific situations. Like, for example, in the last so-called election, which is really an appointment of the Central Committee of the Cuban Communist Party, all of a sudden, a lot of black women were appointed. to the Central Committee. It's the political bureau that really runs the show, but the Central Committee is much more represented than before. So there have been applications of affirmative actions in specific situations, but as a general policy, it has never existed under the revolution, even though the old Cuban Communist Party was in favor of it, by the way. But nonetheless, these people were not only barred from attending the Congress, and the people who were at the Congress, like Miliband, had no idea that was going on. But this is, tells you something about how you can end up doing the playing the game of a repressive government without even your being aware of it, by not being vigilant enough and critical enough to say, well, what kind of a country am I going to in terms of its political system? So a lot of these very prominent Cuban artists and intellectuals were essentially kept out of the Congress, and most of them recanted and were let back in into the system. But a couple of them, particularly Walterio Carbonell, who was one of the main organizers of that protest, spent tremendous amount of time in prison. He's the author of a very important document written in 1961, Cómo surgió la cultura nacional, but a kind of black power, not nationalist, but black power manifesto. It has been translated into English, and Carbonell refused to recant and paid dearly for that, going through prison, through mental asylums, and ending up eventually, when the situation got better, and in fact the Cuban National Library even put, eventually in the 1980s or 90s, when the situation became more liberal, relatively speaking, they even put this thing in their website. But Carbonell himself ended up as an obscure researcher in the library, unknown to most people internationally, and unknown, that's the most unfortunate part of it, to black people in Cuba, who the media would never refer to him. Carbonell had been a member of the old Cuban Communist Party, and listen to this, and this is the irony of ironies of ironies, and he got expelled from the old Cuban Communist Party because he supported the Moncada rebellion of Fidel Castro. And he got expelled from the old Cuban Party for supporting Fidel Castro's rebellion in 1953. Right after the revolution, he was sent as ambassador to the Algerian Liberation Front that was then housed in Tunis. So he had a revolutionary credentials, but that didn't stop him from being punished. So I will stop here, and if this was too much, please let me know, and I'll try to explain it more.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.